Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Becky Cooper, author of We Keep the Dead Close, A Murder at Harvard, and A Half Century of Silence. Becky's a former New Yorker editorial staff member. She wrote, as a senior thesis, a literary biography of David Foster Wallace, and I'll try my hardest not to let this interview become an hour-long dissection of that thesis, because like he's my favorite author, my favorite story. It won Harvard's Hoops Prize, which is a big deal. And she also wrote Mapping Manhattan, which was a unique project, which I highly recommend, as well as reading her pieces in The New Yorker if you have, and you should, a subscription. So We Keep the Dead Close reminds us that cold cases really are never really cold, especially today. Jane Britton died in 1969. Her murderer was identified in 2018, thanks in large part to Becky, who after a decade since matriculating at Harvard returned and began a dogged search as an investigative sleuth to uncover the true identity and story behind the death of this bright and confident woman with a curious personality and a kind of morbid sense of humor, whose archaeological endeavors led in great part to the various misunderstandings behind her death. That death was gruesome, unsolved, and littered with red herrings, mythologized, if you will, and told in halls and around lunch tables at Harvard for decades. So welcome, Becky, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for that introduction, and thanks for having me.
Sure. So this is one of those where the first question really is, tell us the story.
So the story is about a young woman named Jane Britton, who was an archaeology graduate student at Harvard in 1969. And on the morning of generals, she didn't show up for the test. And the test is this major landmark in grad student's career. And even though, you know, she did sort of have a sense of humor and she would be absent for periods at a time, you know, everyone knew that Jane wasn't going to miss this exam. And her boyfriend, Jim Humphreys, was taking the exam that day too. And he realized she wasn't there. He called her twice, she didn't pick up. And then after the exam, he goes to her apartment. And even though he knows better than everyone that her apartment isn't locked because she kind of lived with this insouciance, he doesn't go in and instead talks to the neighbor. And together they go in and realize that Jane is lying face down on her bed, covered with these fur blankets, this red powder, which many people believe to be red ochre, this kind of iron oxide that is spread over many, many human burials. And a headstone is placed next to her bed. She had been bludgeoned to death sometime the night before. And the case, you know, makes all the major papers over the next 3 days. And then all of a sudden, just as people were starting to suspect that it had to have been somebody in Harvard's anthropology department because of the kind of telltale recreation of a burial ritual at the scene, the Cambridge police chief issues a kind of unprecedented press blackout. And nobody really talks about it at all, other than within the halls of the anthropology department. You know, a grand jury hearing gets dissolved within 6 months without finding. Cut to, you know, 45 years later, I'm an undergraduate. And in 2009, I'm having lunch with some friends. And I tried to bait this guy who I know is a great storyteller with some, you know, half-remembered Harvard lore about like a ghost fire truck. And he says, well, if you want to hear a really crazy Harvard story, and proceeds to tell me about the murder of this woman whose name he didn't know. But in his version of the story, the person who had killed her was her advisor. And then I later learned that that advisor was still on faculty. And I just couldn't, let it be something that we were willing to whisper about. I felt like I had to be the one to take the rumor seriously.
Well, I'm gonna take some notes here. One of the things I remember, this is not my list of questions, but one of the things I remember you saying at the beginning is when you go to Harvard, Harvard may change you, but Harvard's not going to change.
Yeah.
And do you think that had anything to do, this is just preliminary, with the idea that they just shut it up and closed it down because it was Harvard?
That to me, so that was a quote from my freshman seminar professor who said, you know, don't expect to change Harvard over the course of your 4 years. It's an institution on a scale you can't imagine. And that quote really resonated to me when I was trying to unpack why Jane's story compelled me from the very beginning. Because I think, you know, what it spoke to me of was an institution whose omnipotence was both amazing. You know, it was how I was allowed to go there with and graduate without loans and have all these opportunities. But it was also, you know, a place that it wasn't hard to imagine it having a dark side. And so I think that's why the version of the rumor that my friend told me had such teeth, because it turned Harvard into a villain that I could recognize. And my question was, like, is this what it turned out to be?
So whenever, since I'm a bookseller and have an independent bookstore, and I say this in every interview, even though everyone says you can't judge a book by its cover, every single person who comes into my bookstore does exactly that. And this cover, the reason why publishers do covers is because they know what will sell. And this cover, like some true crime novels, has just the face of Jane. And it's that one picture that you use where she has this kind of, it's kind of inscrutable expression, mm-hmm. you know? There's something behind it just other than this impassive look. Mm-hmm. And then you have that red faded color. It's a really impressive cover. And I was wondering whether you had a chance to vet it, or there were several that were proposed.
Thank you. Yeah, Grand Central was really great about giving me the opportunity to go back and forth about what I wanted the cover to look like. That I knew from the very moment I saw that picture, which was taken by her friend and neighbor, Don Mitchell, who was one of the people who found her body, that was what I wanted. There was a kind of simultaneous vulnerability and badassness to her gaze.
Exactly.
And I think what I loved the most about it, there's so many true crime books that are black and white and red, and you use the high school yearbook photo of the woman who was murdered. And I definitely didn't want that. And what I loved about this photo is that she's staring dead straight at you and is interrogating you for your interest in her as much as your able to look at her as the viewer. So she turns into both the person being objectified, which is, you know, necessarily, I think, what happens when somebody becomes a subject, but she's also, you know, the person gazing at you.
Yeah, it's funny because the pictures in the book really made a difference, and they really contextualized a lot of what you were writing at exactly the time you were writing it on that page. And the one that really struck me was the one that when she was on the dig, and they're all standing, and she's laying down with, as you say, her sporty top, and she's kind of like that. She has her cigarette in one hand, yeah. And you think, oh, I really like her, and she, you know, she's funny, and she must have been cool, and you know, it's, mm-hmm. And then so many of them, like her parents leaving the apartment, you know, are so poignant, and the way you say her hands are clutching her gloves like claws, but they're all so grainy, and you know, it's all so hard to really pick out. How did you find all the pictures?
It was through just copious amounts of research. I pulled every single article I could find about the case. So I, you know, went through microfiches at libraries and et cetera, et cetera. And then became close to a lot of Jane's friends who were kind and generous and trusting enough to share their photos with me. I hadn't necessarily even been intending to put so many photos in the book. I started doing it just to show my editor that my descriptions were accurate. And I got very attached to them because I think thematically they work because artifacts are really important to the story. You know, she studied archaeology, and I think artifacts as a kind of object that connects past and present was really crucial. And then in addition, I wanted readers to be able to check my work. You know, I wanted you going through it to sort of ask yourself, how much do I trust this narrator? How much is she influencing the way I see the past and allow you to instantly judge for yourself?
Which is what I did when I did my research, starting with Wikipedia and then digging and falling down rabbit holes and then going to your thesis. Oh, so researching, I can't find your thesis. How do I get a hold of it?
I think you can probably request a copy through Harvard's library system, which is called Hollis. I think because it won a Hoops, it's still in the system.
So if I can't find it, I'm going to call you back.
Let me know.
I'll ask you to send it to me. But I'm not going to start with him because, like I said, we can do another interview about it. So the other thing as a bookseller, and also most potential purchasers, though, is they look at the epigraphs, which I do, too, because I'm always thinking, did the epigraphs come first? Did they come after? And how much you must have thought about the epigraphs before you. And they're very arcane epigraphs.
Comes from being a complete concentrator, I imagine.
Yeah, I wondered, you know, when you saw, when it's Claude Levi Strauss, you know, first of all, that's 1/10 of the people, 1% of the people who would look at the epigraph. The idea of this, well, the first idea is the idea that there's this truth and then there's another truth that encompasses it and so forth and so on until you get to an explosion. Mm-hmm. So what did you mean by that first? And why did you choose it? Was it hard to choose or did you know that quote first?
I'll say that, you know, the book didn't start with either of those epigraphs. I think they were things that I came across during my research and they became kind of lodestars for me in a way. You know, they ranked among the quotes that I had on my bulletin board as I was structuring and writing the book. And ultimately they were the ones that felt, especially in juxtaposition with one another, that they kind of encapsulated.
Yeah, especially since the second one deals with DNA, which is what happened in 2018, which is kind of the other side of the coin of the first one, right? They kind of bracket each other.
Exactly. So I wanted it to start, you know, the first one is a quote of Levi Strauss's from Tristes Tropiques, which came out in 55. And then the second one is a quote from Gideon Lewis Krauss, which was in the New York Times in 2019. Tristes Tropiques is this weird kind of travelogue, memoir, ethnography, and it then tracks all the way into what Lewis Krauss was writing about, which is, you know, ancient DNA technology that's like at the forefront of what we're capable of scientifically. And so I liked that it, exactly what you say, that it was bookended. But I think, you know, the reason why Levi Strauss's quote was so important about truth exploding was that I think it kind of mirrored my experience of peeling back the layers of truth and rumor and myth in Jane's story, where, you know, as I said earlier, the person at the heart of the original rumor that I heard was a professor who was still on faculty. And as I got deeper and deeper and deeper into the story, I'm not really spoiling anything because this comes out pretty early, that, you know, it became clear to me that it didn't seem that he was guilty of murdering her. And so my question became, if that's the case, then number one, who did kill Jane? And number two, why is this the story that we're deciding to tell? And there's another quote that means a lot to me by an anthropologist named Vina Das, who says, you know, some realities need to be fictionalized in order to be apprehended. And so my job seemed to me in some ways to say, all right, here's the fiction, but what reality is it trying to gesture at? And so sometimes the distinction between the two for me felt so volatile that it almost felt explosive.
Yeah, it's funny because the first quote and the one you just made are so metaphysical that they don't seem like they should apply to a real thing that happened. You know, it's like, yeah, it's out there in the ether and you can see these circles encompassing other circles, but what does that really mean in the quotidian day-to-day life or death? Which reminds me, like, so how did things get so confused? Like the cigarettes, mm-hmm. the cigarette burns, hundreds of cigarettes. How could he smoke them all at one time so calmly? Or the ochre, or the witnesses who did hear things, but probably didn't hear things. All that kind of stuff, which I guess, you know, occurs in every case.
Yeah, I mean, I just think with the game of telephone, if you don't have answers and so much of it is relegated to oral history precisely because of the press blackout where people were relying on this information to be transmitted from one to the next to the next. You know, the graduate students in the anthropology department kept a physical file on the case that they would pass down almost talismanically from one generation to the next. And so it isn't kind of any surprise, I think, to me that things get distorted over time. And that was another reason that Levi Strauss was so important to me, because another of his books looks at myths as part of a larger myth system. And it asks the question, you know, not what is the content of this myth but instead, what are the ways in which the myth's distortions over time as it gets told and retold, how does that reflect on the community or the individual who's telling the story? How does that tell me what their values are or what they're trying to speak to that otherwise has no outlet?
Yeah, and basically it's a much more compelling story and much more interesting and entertaining, which is not grotesque, but it's, you know, not nice. The other thing that's like a novel or like a movie is her apartment was a mess, mm-hmm. and it was in a lousy area, and there wasn't any deadbolt at the front, even though they wanted, and her door was always unlocked. It was just kind of weird. And she went to Radcliffe, and her parents were mm-hmm. had plenty of money. That confused me. I never really understood it. I know it happened, but I never really understood why she lived that way.
I think, you know, that was an apartment that, yeah, it was run down, but it was, you know, kind of passed down from one generation to the next of anthropology students that, you know, her neighbors were in the graduate program with her, had found her the apartment. And I think, you know, she wasn't really afraid. You know, I think she kind of enjoyed living a little bit rebelliously. And it wasn't that it was that she was living in kind of dangerous squalor, even though, you know, the apartment had a history of violent attacks. But, you know, it wasn't as bad, I don't think, as the newspapers made it out to seem. But, it definitely wasn't like a square, safe, you know, suburban home. But I think the other question is, you know, weren't her parents able to get more answers when it would seem that, you know, if her father was the vice president of Radcliffe, couldn't he have made kind of more of a fuss and made sure that it wasn't buried under silence? I looked into that a lot, and my guess is that as somebody who was welcomed into an institution like Harvard, he wasn't born into it. You know, he grew up, I believe, in Missouri and used to play in jazz bands on, you know, boats up and down the Mississippi. He felt like he wasn't in a position to be able to question those institutions that he had kind of built his life around, believing and being accepted into. And then in some ways, by kicking up these questions about who his daughter was, the way that people were asking the question seemed to blame her for what befell her. And you know, at times it seemed like not only was his daughter dead, but then her reputation was going to be besmirched in the kind of unearthing of what happened. And so maybe in some ways there was a kind of self-preservation in that silence, even though, you know, it was corrosive to the family.
And the other thing is the way you fleshed her out, like anecdotally, like walking into a room and saying, the rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated. And see, we're laughing about it. You know, this is a tragedy that we're laughing about, and that's what happens. But it really turns into a real person for the reader.
Oh, thank you. I tried really hard.
That's a hard one to find, too, I guess, that quote.
Yeah. You mean just like in terms of research trying to find?
Yeah. It's just an odd thing to find.
It was from somebody who was in the room when she said it. And he said, I think probably because of what happened, he's never been able to forget it. I then corroborated it with someone else who said, oh, no, she did. Because it would have been hard to just pin such an indelible quote on just one person saying, yeah, I think this happened.
Yeah. It's like I always, if I was going to be buried, I always thought my epitaph should be, you know, I told you I was sick.
You know? That's grim. So you probably liked Jane's sense of humor.
Exactly. No, yes, I thought about that as I was reading about her. This is something I would say.
Yeah.
Well, so what's the deal with her advisor? I mean, you know, mm-hmm. you say, and I don't want to, again, spoil anything or go anywhere I shouldn't, so I'll leave it up to you. But where is he? Who is he? Is, you know, if you want to talk about it.
Sure. I'm trying to figure out a way to talk about it without spoiling the ending. Right. He was her advisor, that he led a dig that she and a few others from Harvard went on in Iran in the summer of 1968. And according to the rumor that I had heard, she and this professor had an affair. And that allegedly when police heard about this and he was asked about that affair. He was married. He said, you know, why would I have, he was quoting Paul Newman, you know, why would I have a hamburger when I have steak at home? And was kind of dismissive about that in some ways. When people asked about the alleged hostilities that had taken place in Iran, he said, yeah, we ate too much tuna fish. And so people really scrutinized his behavior. And, you know, by the time I then hear the case, he's still a teacher at Harvard. And so my first instinct, which my mother probably loved, was to sit in on his class, you know, sit a few seats away from him and try to understand who this person was. Either, you know, was he the person at the heart of this rumor who seemed to be capable of murder, or was he somebody who was able to withstand a rumor like that? And I just wanted to know more about his character. And it, you know, I do think it's important going in to realize that he didn't kill her. And so the kind of dual question to me of who he was and why people were so ready to believe it is really the interesting question to me in that regard.
And it's not like you were like spilling the beans. I mean, it was out there. That is out there.
Yes.
So has he responded to, has he gotten in touch with you?
Oh, I fact checked with him. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We went through the whole, it was a multi-day going through, because I wanted the book as much as possible, to be fair. I wanted him to have an opportunity to respond to the allegations in the book, which, you know, are not related to the murder, but maybe related to the reason why people were so ready to believe it. I also wanted an opportunity to kind of, you know, he always talks about the importance of putting artifacts in their context, putting them in their story. And you know, as much as I've tried really hard to have Jane be more than just the victim that a lot of other true crime books can flatten someone into, you know, I wanted him to have moments of like the fullness of his humanity. And so I wanted to make sure I got those right.
Yeah. And then there were the other early on possibilities, like the neighbor having blood.
Mm-hmm.
She made like two excuses that I thought, oh, well, maybe, you know, because mm-hmm. they were lousy excuses.
Mm-hmm.
That happened as well. I mean, definitely. Obviously.
Yeah, that happened. Yeah. I mean, when the case was solved in 2018, the police files that I had been a kind of annoying fly buzzing around them, I don't know where I was going with that analogy, but anyway, they finally released the police files to me. And the results of the blood test were there from that moment. So you're talking about when Don and Jill Mitchell had a kind of benzidine reagent test on their hands. And the results of that corroborated what Don Mitchell had told me in our interview. And so that was another point of like, okay, now I've squared it and I can put that on the text.
And then switching back again to the idea of, as opposed to the investigation, personalizing her, just the part, because both you and I probably feel the same way. She loved Vonnegut.
Mm-hmm.
And the two quotes from Vonnegut, a series of, especially The Sirens of Titan, which is my favorite. And that really, you know, made me feel like she was my friend, you know, that she and I shared that.
No.
Well, I mean, yeah. And I guess that's also from talking to other people who knew her and from, yeah, I guess that's what that was from.
Yeah. That in particular was from, I think, the Robert Reinold profile of her that was published on January 19th, the year that she died. And I think he ended his profile about her with that, because I mean, it's a short profile. It's probably like 8 paragraphs long. But I think he recognized, the quote is, you know, I was a victim of a series of accidents, as are we all. And I think he recognized the resonance that quote might have for someone, you know, who seemed in some ways to be able to predict some kind of sword of Damocles hanging over her. You know, she's also the type of woman who said to a graduate student friend of hers, I have dreams of waking up dead in that apartment.
Right.
And the nesting of dream and reality is almost this like Twin Peaks untangleable knot, but also how did she know, or what does it mean to feel that way?
It's not much different than what's happening in our world today, you know, with a Supreme Court justice being appointed and the idea that 60 senators being required and now 50, you know, all these things, it's like the great Mandela, everything's like clicking into place. Yeah. Like in the Sirens of Titan, where one piece of strapping metal is what, you know, Trafalgar, what is needed. And it's just these things all come together at one time. But then the kind of denouement, or when you essentially, let's say you're one of those people that solves crimes that the police and the FBI cannot solve. And, you know, now there's documentaries about, I don't want to say people like you, mm-hmm. but people who are doing exactly what you're doing mm-hmm. that other folks haven't been able to accomplish, you know? So like, is that something that you now feel, I don't mean as a vocation, but it's, you were specifically concerned with this because when you first heard this story, it began to gnaw at you mm-hmm. and stayed with you. Mm-hmm. It's not something that you want to go out now and be this
true crime vigilante detective. No, I don't, you know, I would hope to be surprised for what my next maybe 10-year long, maybe 5-year long project will be. I'm not closed off to the possibility that it would be something else that needs solving, but I don't imagine myself as, you know, feeling compelled to solve every true crime case in the world. You know, I think there was something very special and I describe it as alchemical in my bond with Jane. You know, I think that it means a lot to hear that you came to think of her as a friend, because that's very much how I came to feel about her and tried to convey, you know, the fullness of her personality. And, you know, why I was laughing before when she walked into the room and said, rumors of my death are greatly exaggerated. Like, she was so funny and so magnetic. And so, you know, I felt so lucky to be able to spend so much time with her. And so that was one ingredient that allowed me to be so compelled to see this story through. And I think the other one was that it following her story led me to an even larger one about systemic injustice and gender discrimination in academia, that it wasn't just that I was looking at one instance of a woman being silenced in 1969. You know, her story to me was a gateway into something that my friends are still experiencing now. And so I think, you know, when I couldn't feel certain that my investigation would do anything but hurt some of the people in her life who didn't want to pursue it. To me, the ability to say to myself, but it's not just unearthing their pain, which is the side effect of this. It's also being able to voice the experience of so many women in academia who feel like they have no system. There is no recourse for them. They're in such a kind of vulnerable position that kind of power asymmetry doesn't allow them to tell their story.
Do you think if it had been a man murdered, that anything would have happened differently?
That's an interesting question. I don't actually think that Harvard, for all of my research, all these 10 years, I have not found a single piece of evidence that they impeded Jane's getting justice. So would they have been able to put more pressure? I mean, I don't really know whether, if the particular circumstances of Jane's murder were, you know, applicable exactly to this hypothetical man who was killed, which is problematic to imagine in multiple ways, but you know, I don't necessarily see how, if that were true, they would have been able to solve it any quicker, even if there were more pressure because of it being higher profile for whatever reason. So no, I don't necessarily think so.
This is about as peripheral as I can get and still bring in David Foster Wallace. But you know, you read a lot of articles about him, like many of the Me Too movement guys who are canceled. You know, you read articles that say, I loved him, but then I found out what kind of person he is, and now I can't read him the same way. How do you feel about that? Like, I still look at the art or what's been done, and then I can easily separate myself from what they did as people. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think I still have Infinite Jest at the top of my reread list, but I think, you know, my thesis, if you get your hands on it, is nearly hagiographic. You know, I turn to him, the kind of structure of it is looking at what I deem the kind of three existential questions over different periods of his life. And I was trying to learn through how he explored those questions or tried to answer them, kind of my own way through exactly those dilemmas. And so I think for me, the revelations of his mistreatment of women makes me have to retell myself the story about what I can learn from him, or what role he plays in my life as a kind of lodestar. That you know, so much of the book about Jane is about being critical about the stories you tell yourself, being, you know, as informed as possible, and not just allowing the story that is most convenient to you to be the one that you guide your life by. And I think my revision of David Foster Wallace is a really good example of needing to come back and say, this is uncomfortable for me to have to complicate my understanding of my idol, but it's necessary if I'm going to be authentic to both, you know, the thesis of the book that I'm writing now, and also to my own values.
Yeah, and it goes back to the Levi Strauss quote, because those circles, while you're in them, you're not aware of them, unless it's like Flatland and Spearland. Yeah. Unless you're standing above it, looking back down, you have no idea where you are or what circle you're in.
There's a quote that I really love in the book from one of the anthropologists who I speak to, and she says, it's really hard to admit you belong to the world that you're studying.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I don't know, you could call it meta, you could call it breaking the fourth wall, you can call it whatever you want, but there is this part of the difficulty of my life is I'm always stepping outside. And, you know, there's a good side and a bad side to being able to do that. It's hard to get things done if you're always looking back at what you're doing.
That kind of psychic alienation.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's, you know, like going to a psychiatrist and saying, who am I? You know? But yeah, I can see, actually, it's nice that you kind of brought all that together, because yeah, here's this woman who has been gone from us for 50 years, and that you and I both feel, well, you much more than me, feel as if you know her, but she's not here, and she hasn't been here. Mm-hmm. And you really don't know whether she was ever here, but you also know that you like her and you would like to have had lunch with her, you know, or had a drink with her, right?
I would love that. I'd like to think that she'd want to spend time with me, but I don't know.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, and that does, well, would you like to go to lunch with David Foster Wallace?
I would like to meet him, very much. No, I would like to meet him.
Did you ever see, who's the guy who was canceled for the same reason? Charlie Rose. Did you ever see the interview with him and Charlie Rose?
Mm-hmm, where he talks about why he wears a bandana, because he's afraid it's going to explode.
Yeah, and then half the things he says, then he goes, oh, yeah. You know, it's
I mean, I think, yeah, maybe the similarity between Jane, or writing the book about Jane and writing my thesis about Wallace, is that with both of them, I think one of the compelling visceral feelings of why I needed to write it and what it felt like writing it was this flush of recognition. With Wallace, it was the way his brain works, the like kind of nesting of thought upon thought, and the way that you kind of get lost in it and paralyzed by it. And he felt to me like somebody in the corner of the room at a party who said, you know, who would sort of wink at you and say, don't worry, I see it too. And Jane, to me, I also felt that flush of recognition. It was different, but she, I think there was a kind of, you know, for all of her ambition and all of her accomplishments and all of her wit and causticness and whatnot, she was also extremely vulnerable and lonely in a pretty fundamental way that I think comes from sort of seeing too much. And I really related to that. It felt like, you know, working on this book, working on her story, like she kept me company in my feeling that way.
Yeah, I think that you will do different stuff, because when I think about that, the thesis with that, which should be published, but anyway, when I think of that, and then I think of Mapping Manhattan. Mm-hmm. So there are three completely different things. Mm-hmm. And what's the one thing that connects them? They're definitely different from each other. And Mapping Manhattan is one where you weren't necessarily the one that you wanted to tell the story. You weren't the story.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, I think what connects them is, you know, when I started college, I didn't think I was going to study literature. I wanted to study neuroscience because I wanted to be able to study the way people think. I wanted to be able to, you know, it sounds so freshman idealistic, but I wanted to understand the mechanisms of how someone else thought so I could kind of approximate what it might feel like to be someone else. And so, you know, the act of writing a biography for me is trying to crawl in as close as I can possibly get. You know, writing Jane's book, I took a week to just type every single letter that her brother gave to me and to kind of feel the rhythm of her words coursing through me is such an intimate gesture that you get so close to the patterns of thought of someone else. And to me, Mapping Manhattan, which is my first book, it was a collection of people's personalized maps of Manhattan, in which I said, you know, maps are more about their makers than the places they describe. And really what I was trying to do was kind of have people do an accidental autobiography and show me the way that their brain filters things, show me the way that this place registers to them on an emotional level, kind of in a similar way to kind of crawl inside their brain for a moment. And you know, I think the other similarity that Jane, the book about Jane and the book about maps have is that in both cases, I'm kind of advocating the authority of the historian or the cartographer, where I'm sort of trying to find the truth in the multiplicity and saying, you know, here's the necessary subjectivity of either the historian or the cartographer, and what is important in foregrounding that? What actually do you learn from that, rather than, you know, why should I try to hide that?
It's funny. I thought I was going to irritate you about the David Foster Wallace thing, but now it's like, yeah, now we now kind of have an understanding. I think you've just given us an understanding of you. How did you get the celebrities to get involved in Mapping Manhattan? You were just a kid.
Yeah, I was a kid who wrote a lot of letters. I wrote, Yoko Ono did a map for Mapping Manhattan, and that really was just a letter out of the blue to the Dakota, and I let my father mail it because the Beatles are his god. And, you know, my mom calls me. I think I was still living at home at that point. And she says, you got a map from the Dakota, or you got an envelope from the Dakota. And I was like, I'll come right home. I want to read it. And she just was so, I thought a lot of the Steve Jobs quote in his biography where he'd been after her for the particular photo of her and John with the flowers in bed. And, you know, he'd been going through all the circles of publicity, not getting it. And they're seated next to each other at a dinner party. And she hands it to him. And he says, you know, I know, or, you know, she's such an easy woman, or, oh, I'm going to butcher the quote. Anyway, like, I could see how easy it would be to fall in love with her, something to that effect, that, like, in that gesture, he really understood the true kindness of her, which I felt on exhibit when she sent me the map.
Yeah, and going to truth, and then John Lennon, give me some truth. It's like, it's so hard for so many people to feel that way about her. Mm-hmm. You know, she's been turned into something that she's not. Yeah. Or I assume she's not. I don't know. I have my own opinions about, did she break up the Beatles and things like, and I'm sure your father does too. Mm-hmm. Does he hate her?
No, not at all. No, I think, yeah, she's someone who deserves a much more complex narrative than I think society at large has allowed her.
Maybe that'll be our next one then. Actually, that would be a cool one. Okay, well, this was great, and I was able to talk about David Foster without getting upset. So
no, it's you threaded the needle. I think my interests are quite disparate, so it's nice to be able to talk about what kind of is so foundational that aligns all of them.
Yeah, and it was so funny because I came across it because I was doing exactly the kind of work that you did to create all of your projects. It's just finding out who you were.
I'm impressed by your research.
Thanks. It was a great book, and I look forward to talking to you again when I find out what your next topic is going to be.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so long.
Take care.